Hannah Murray on TRE in the afternoon.
Joining us on the line now is Elizabeth McClampy, a lawyer whose work focuses on animal rights and protection. She actually received an award for her work with Harvard Law's Animal Law and Policy Program in 2021. Her book, Forget the Camel, The Madcap World of Animal Festivals and What They Say About Being Human, is an immersive entry into the sights, smells, tastes and noise of animal festivals across the US. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for joining us. So this is a really fascinating subject. Why did you decide to look into the world of animal festivals?
So it's a little bit of there's a personal reason and a more like academic professional reason. So the personal reason is that my grandmother was an anthropologist who studied human-animal relationships. And before she died, she was just starting to think about a book that would sort of be like an anthology of animal festivals around the world. And she had some notes and some clippings and some files and that sort of thing, but she passed away before she could finish her book. And so I, you know, knew about this growing up, and I sort of was reminded of her work when I was in law school, and thought that it might be really worthwhile to pick up where she left off. So that was my like introduction to the topic. But then as I began doing my own research and thinking about these animal festivals a little more in depth, I realized that there's a lot to say about them. And I think that they happen all over the United States and the world. And I think as a category, it's a topic of animal issues that hasn't been explored very thoroughly. So I was excited to kind of do that research and see what how I could contribute to, you know, how we think about human-animal relationships.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's a really fascinating subject. I mean, the idea of animals being used for any kind of entertainment is a controversial one, isn't it? That has changed. I think people's views have changed massively over the years, from when it was really normal for animals to be used in circuses to now. You know, a lot has changed in the last 20 or 30 years.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that that's one of the reasons that drew me to thinking about animal festivals, is that we don't have the same sort of like necessity argument when we're talking about entertainment as we do when we talk about food or research or other things where we use animals. I think people, you know, have different opinions about how those treatments of animals are necessary for certain, you know, certain goods that we provide to society. But with entertainment, you know, the good is definitely there. There's a lot of identity building and community building and all of that, but it's not quite as defensible as some of these other things. So it's, I think, a really fruitful way to interrogate our assumptions and ideas about animals.
Yeah. So tell us about some of these festivals. Can you, where does the title Forget the Camel come from?
Yeah. So Forget the Camel comes from the camel and ostrich races that take place in Virginia City, Nevada, which are basically, you know, what they sound like. Jockeys race ostriches and camels against each other, sort of around a little track. And it's a very slapstick humor type event. You know, it's not like a serious race like the Kentucky Derby or anything like that, but it's very much an endurance race of sorts. You know, these animals don't want to be ridden. And so they're continuously trying to buck the humans off of their backs. And, you know, many humans, these jockeys fall off of the animals and slam into the ground. And it's, you know, it's meant to be sort of this kind of uproarious kind of event where that slapstick humor is kind of, that violence is a piece of it. And so at this event, I was watching the heats of different camels and ostriches and other animals racing each other. And during one camel heat, one jockey fell off the camel and really kind of hit the ground quite hard. And all of the handlers rushed to control the camel. So they sort of ran over to the camel and tried to grab its reins and all of that. And the MC shouted out, you know, forget the camel, check on Charlie. And so Charlie being the human who was lying there on the ground, and these handlers had rushed to control the camel instead. And so to me, that was just such a, like, kind of like microcosm of this whole world of animal festivals more broadly, where we put animals at the center of the festival. We name the festivals after them. We use them for the entertainment and for the celebrations and all of that. But we can't actually think too hard about what happens to the animals, because if we do like that, it makes it not so fun anymore. So there's this process going on where you are using these animals as the focal point of the celebration, while you're also purposefully ignoring kind of their experience of the event and whatever harm they might be encountering.
Yes, it's very hypocritical, isn't it? I think a lot of humans feel like that when it comes for animals and all the different kind of ways that animals are used for humans.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that sort of like dissonance of how we use animals, you know, a lot of people, most people, even many of the people I spoke with while doing the research for this book, love animals. And they'll say that. And they like, you know, at some of these events, they'll say, oh, no, we love these animals. And I think it is this kind of give and take where that love can look like a lot of different things. And I think sometimes that involves hurting animals, even if that's not really the main intention.
Yeah, it's a weird one, isn't it? I mean, when you look at animals being used for any kind of entertainment, whether it's whales having to jump up high in a sea life park, or these races that go on, or in circuses, or all kinds of things, the question surely needs to be asked whether the animal is enjoying themselves, whether the animal is meant to be doing this kind of work or entertainment. There's a lot of controversy here in Spain, because there's certain areas where donkeys are used to take tourists around, and the donkeys are kept in not great conditions at all, and the tourists are often far too big to be riding these donkeys. But it's a tradition that's been going on for many, many years, and that's how it's justified. But a lot of people, for obvious reasons, disagree with it and think that it's very cruel for the animals and needs to be stopped. So tradition seems to be a sort of argument for a lot of these things, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. And I found that over and over again in my research, that every single event I went to, for the most part, was exactly like you just said, justified in large part by the tradition of it. And some of these traditions, you know, go back pretty far, 100 years or so, but others aren't quite so old. And then even their history is sort of rooted in basically like the fact that it exists. Like, it becomes self-evident that, you know, because we've done this for 60 years, that's justification enough. Even if, like, the camel and ostrich race, that was started kind of as a joke 60 years ago. And so it wasn't rooted in this like deep cultural context. It was just sort of this thing that happened. And now it has become this annual event that's sort of grown and taken on a different life. And so it is this sort of thing where tradition becomes this like I said, self-evident justification for these abuses, but it doesn't have to be. And so I think that's one of the things that my book really tries to grapple with, is tradition brings a lot of good to people. It really does. It brings a lot of meaning and a lot of cultural identity and a lot of community. But, you know, when tradition has a victim, I think it's part of our job as humans to continually reassess our relationship with those traditions.
Mm. And are there people at these various animal festivals throughout the US, are there people against it? Are there petitions? Are there protests of people trying to stop it? Or does it seem like everybody's in favor and thinks it's great?
There definitely is some attention towards stopping some of these festivals. I will say that I think the level of attention that is given to the festival really depends on sort of like how bad the festival is. So my book is structured into three parts to sort of, show kind of how we relate to animals more generally at these festivals. So the first part is called dominance. The second part is called humor. And the third part is reverence. And so in those three parts, I sort of sort these animal festivals out into the different categories to try to help explore how we, you know, how we're relating to animals, how we're using these festivals to build that sort of cultural knowledge about animals. And the dominance section starts with an event called the Rattlesnake Roundup, which takes place in Texas. And at this event, they basically, you know, hunt and round up a bunch of rattlesnakes. They keep them alive in this pit, and then they behead them and skin them like in front of the audiences. And so this is a very kind of gory, gruesome event. And so because of that, that event has the most, I think, sort of negative attention that I saw from activists and, you know, conservationists and all sorts of people who see harm in that event and sort of in the surrounding activities of that event. But my book ends with the reverence section, and that section ends with a Butterfly Days parade and festival, which is in the one I went to takes place in California. And it's very like a quaint parade of school children dressed up as monarch butterflies, just welcoming the butterflies back on their migratory journey. And so, you know, that event doesn't have any negative attention. So it does sort of depend on the festival and the level of harm. But I will say most of these events that I went to have some opposition, even if it's just sort of in a remote corner of the internet. Some people are asking these questions.
Yeah, interesting. And what about this lobster boil on Maine's Atlantic coast? I'm a little bit nervous to ask about this, but is it as bad as it sounds?
Yeah, the lobster, the Maine Lobster Festival is the second chapter in the dominance section. So it comes right after that rattlesnake roundup I just described. And it is, it's a very different event in some ways where, you know, it's really kind of communal. It's based on the festival centers around eating lobsters. So there's this big food tent where you can buy lobster dinners, you can buy a lobster salad, lobster, you know, all sorts of things, clams, clam chowder, oysters. I mean, any sort of seafood you can buy there. And I sort of use this as an example where I think dominance can look really obvious in a case like the rattlesnake roundup, where we're, you know, beheading snakes and we're making handprints with the blood and we're doing all sorts of really kind of gory things. But with animals that we often treat or consider to be food, it doesn't sort of have that same affect about the festival. And so I try to make the argument that the Maine Lobster Festival is actually quite similar to the rattlesnake roundup, where, you know, people are hunting these animals and bringing them in alive into a central facility. They're killing them in a way that is not particularly humane en masse in front of tourists. They're then eating the bodies and, you know, making souvenirs and stuff with the sort of body parts after that. And that at the end of the day, the main point of both festivals is killing animals. And so I think I used it sort of as a thought exercise to push people's boundaries of what dominance actually looks like, because I think a lot of people interact with lobster and seafood and animals that we eat for food as, you know, they wouldn't use the word dominance to describe that. But I think, you know, putting it next to the rattlesnake roundup, it becomes really clear that there's something really similar going on at those events.
Mm. It's a really fascinating one, which I've discussed many times with friends and family over the years, how so many people, this is where the hypocrisy, I think, comes into it. And I'm absolutely including myself in this category. I'm not pointing the finger at other people at all. But there are lots of people, I think, in the world who consider themselves to be animal lovers and will think that a lot of these festivals are wrong and inhumane and cruel for the animals. But yet they quite happily eat meat and seafood and lobster and things like that, and don't see that there's any, any comparison, really. There are animals that are meant for food and that's fine. And then the other animals that we don't tend to eat should be left alone and be happy and things like that. And I think a lot of people don't want to know how the animals they're eating have been killed, because the reality is if they did know a lot of the details, it would make them feel really uncomfortable about their choices, you know. So I think a lot of people would rather not know and just be happy in their world eating what comes out of their fridge without really trying to understand the process that animal's been through to go onto their plate.
Exactly. And I think that dissonance, that hypocrisy, you know, whatever you want to call it, is really natural. I mean, I certainly have felt it at many points in my life. And it's one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book about animal festivals is I think on the one hand, you can look at a topic like animal festivals and as an animal, you know, advocate myself, you can sort of roll your eyes because you're like, well, this affects a handful of animals, relatively speaking, at a handful of events, sort of nothing in the scope or scale of industrial animal agriculture or animal testing or research or that sort of thing. I mean, those harms are so much greater by the numbers and I think by the severity of what happens to the animals. And I think on the one hand, you could make that argument, sort of, why are we focusing on festivals at all? But on the other hand, it actually felt to me like a really exciting way to talk about animal issues, because when you start talking about food animals, people have all sorts of defensive mechanisms that kick in to justify that dissonance, to explain, you know, why they eat the way they eat, everyone sort of has their own story. Mm. lets us all sleep at night about why we eat, how we eat, or how we use animals in our world, that I think, you know, that is really necessary to keep our life kind of going. And because of that, when you bring up, oh, let's talk about animals raised for food, people have a lot of thoughts and people feel really defensive sometimes. And I think that's all really natural. But when you start talking about festivals, especially some of these ones I've chosen, they're a little more, you know, off the beaten path. I think it allows people, I hope, to engage with the issues and the questions and the sort of the moral debates without that rise of defensiveness or kind of default responses and assumptions coming to the table. So I wanted to create a way for people to think, oh, like, you know, the rattlesnake roundup is really wrong. How is that different from the lobster festival? And really ask those questions in a way that I wanted to be non-threatening and non sort of judgmental, non-self-righteous, like all of those things. But in a way that I did hope would lead readers to, you know, really kind of think about how we treat animals more broadly.
Mm. Oh, definitely. I remember seeing a cartoon once of a group of people that were made to look, you know, wealthy, sitting around a table, tucking into steak dinners and lobsters and, you know, eating really what would be described as, you know, expensive, affluent food that are all animal products, discussing exactly these types of issues, discussing bullfighting, which obviously we have here in Spain, which is incredibly controversial, as you can imagine, and other things like that, and saying how cruel it is for the animals, the poor animals treated so cruelly by these humans, and how wrong it is whilst they're all eating meat and lobster and things. And it is a very fascinating one. My mother was a very passionate vegan. So a lot, I had these sorts of discussions with her very, very regularly. And she was a vegan for ethical reasons, because she loved animals and didn't want to eat them, and never kind of really understood how people could talk about being such passionate animal lovers yet still eat them. She didn't get it at all. And it was really difficult, because that's most people we know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, you know, I went vegan. I stopped eating animal products around 5 years ago. And I think I'm grateful in some ways that that happened later in my life, so that I could really, you know, remember that dissonance. I think once you become vegan, it becomes sort of self-evident. Like I said, you sort of like, and like, it sounds like your mom had that experience of like, it just seems so right. And I think it's hard to bridge that gap with non-vegans, which exactly as you mentioned is most people. Most people love animals and eat them. And I think I remember that journey, that thought journey, and sort of that learning journey in myself. And I think that it helps to sort of remember that, you know, these changes are really hard because of the way all of our sort of societies treat animals. We're not taught to take seriously their suffering and their pain and their interests. We're taught that animals are food. And I think that it takes a lot of time and a lot of effort to undo that teaching.
Yeah, definitely. And for a lot of people, and again, this will be difficult for passionate vegans to understand, but for a lot of people, it's really about convenience. And, you know, to be completely vegan is a massive commitment. And depending on where you live, depending on how often you like to go out for dinner or to go around to people's houses for dinner, how sociable you are, how much food is a big part of your life, to be vegan, if you're surrounded by people and restaurants where there's lots of meat and seafood, is a massive, massive life choice that can be very difficult for people.
Absolutely. And I think that's, you know, when I talk to my friends or my family about it, it's, I am constantly trying to remind people that it's not an all or nothing mindset. I think in some ways the word vegan, you know, does a lot of harm because it makes it seem like you either have to claim it and be really perfect, or, you know, you're an omnivore and that there's nothing in between. And I think the truth is, if every single person on this planet just sort of ate a little less meat, we'd be in a better place. And I really don't believe it has to be all or nothing. And I think that's, you know, it wasn't for me, I didn't go vegan overnight, right? It took a year. I started cutting things out sort of one at a time and testing out and trying new recipes and all of that. And it does take time. And I think that that mindset of perfection keeps a lot of people from being willing to try what that looks like. And I think it, you know, it does take sacrifice. And I think sometimes it's just about remembering, you know, like I said, remembering the victims of these behaviors. It's not eating, you know, eating a chicken sandwich is not victimless, even if we wish it was.
Yeah. And it's also there are people who take it to the next level in terms of veganism, where You know, there are people who don't eat honey because they say it's cruel to the bees. I've heard people don't eat avocado because there's lots of insects that are killed in the production of avocado. And you kind of go, well, where does it end? You know, I bet you could find reasons to not eat all kinds of vegetables because of, you know, killing insects and stuff. It's yeah, as you say, for it to be all or nothing is a bit crazy.
Yeah. And I think that vegan is not like a destination. Like, vegan is not a perfect word. It's not, I don't think that perfection really exists in being vegan. I think when I think about it for me and my life and my sort of choices, I think it's just about really committing to this issue that really matters to me and just trying to live in alignment with my values. And I think sometimes that is easier than others, by, you know, certainly. But I do think it's just a journey that you have to sort of slowly build some confidence in and make, you know, choice after choice after choice. And then eventually that starts adding up to be more compassionate. But I do think that, you know, the where does it end argument is a really good one, but I don't think that that means we shouldn't start. And so I think that's a lot of people who, you know, are omnivores or are sort of the type of person that loves animals but eats them. I think they're afraid to engage with this world at all because they know they'll never be perfect at it. They'll never be the type of person who doesn't eat avocados because of the insects. And, you know, I'm not sure I'll be that person. Like, I think that any step you can make on this journey of eating less animals, eating fewer animals, I think is a good one. And, you know, I will say my book is not vegan propaganda. I think it's the book is meant to push how people think about animals, because I think one of the reasons we all eat so many animals and abuse them in so many ways is because it is habit. We do it unthinkingly. And so I wanted to sort of unravel how we create some of those assumptions about animals. How do we build that cultural knowledge about animals that they're meant to be used as props or tools or entertainment or food or whatever? And I think those questions are really at the heart of the book. And so, you know, I hope that it leads readers to think about their relationship with animals, but it's not sort of about that piece specifically.
Yeah. And I feel like I know what the answer will be to this question, but through researching this book and looking at the different animal festivals throughout America, has there been any that you have come across that you've thought, you know what, I don't think that's too bad. I think that's okay. I think that's kind of acceptable.
Yeah. So the very last festival in the book that I mentioned before, the Butterfly Days Parade and festival was a very sweet, very quaint event. It was this little, very like kind of small town parade where the school children dressed up as caterpillars and then butterflies. And it was just like this very kind of classic small town American event. And I think that event, I put it as the very last chapter in the book in part to end on a hopeful place. So this isn't a book that's solely doom and gloom about how, oh, we just need to stop all of this. I think it really is about thinking through how we relate to these animals and how we use them and what benefits we get out of those celebrations. So I think there are benefits absolutely to using it, to having these festivals and to having these annual celebrations in small towns. Like, I think it brings a lot of meaning. It passes heritage and tradition down to children. Like, all of those things are goods that are provided to the communities. But I think the Butterfly Days Parade and Festival is an example of an event that has evolved over the years. You know, they used to capture monarchs and release them and sort of like a lot would die in the process, just sort of like everything else in the book. But they've adapted and evolved and continued to grow and change how they celebrate this core part of their own tradition and history. And because of that, the festival, I think, has a very peaceful, thoughtful energy about it, whereas some of the others, I think, are still, you know, doing the same thing they've done for 50 years just because that's a reason enough. And so the book, I end with that place of hope of, you know, if we really do start thinking about this, it doesn't mean we have to cancel all these events. I just think it means we have to think, okay, how can we do this better and differently? You know, how can we include the animal's perspective and at least basic interest in not being harmed in our celebrations?
Yeah. There must be plenty of people around the world, not just in America, obviously, that have been involved in a lot of these festivals, whether they've started the festival or just been working at them in whatever capacity, that have thought that they were brilliant entertainment, great fun, and were totally for the whole experience for traditional reasons or whatever, who have for various reasons, changed their mind over the years and thought, you know what, I feel differently about this now. I feel differently about the animals and I feel uncomfortable with my role in this and actually want to step away or finish the event if they have that power. That must happen, mustn't it?
Yeah, I think it does. And I think that you see that a lot in... So like I mentioned, this book was originally thought of by my grandmother. And so when I began to do this research, I had access to her notes from some of the visits that she had done 30 years ago or 35 years ago before she passed away. And I was able to kind of compare and contrast how she was experiencing these events versus what I saw, you know, in the 21st century. And because of that, I had this like window into, you know, what has changed, what has stayed the same over the last 30 years. And I think what has changed in a lot of them is a real a developed focus on animal welfare. So even though the core problem, the core event hasn't changed in most of these cases, there's a lot more sort of like talk and attention and like resources and websites and social media posts and all of that about animal welfare. And so I think that is an indication of change. That is saying people, attendees, social media commenters, organizers, everyone is starting, I think, to think more critically about the animals' experience of all of these events. And so welfare is the first answer to that. I don't think it's the last answer, but that's my personal thought. But I think it's the first, you know, line of defense in some ways against these critiques of these events is to say, well, we take care of the animals. And so I view that as a very positive change. I think it means that these conversations are starting to happen and that they started to happen over the last 30 years and hopefully will continue to.
Yeah. It's like animals being used for transporting humans and now they keep them in the shade.
Exactly.
It's that kind of thing that they're at least going towards thinking about the animals' welfare, even if they haven't stopped it altogether.
Exactly.
Well, it's a fascinating subject. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about it, Elizabeth McLampy. If people want to get a copy of your book, it's called Forget the Camel, The Madcap World of Animal Festivals and What They Say About Being Human. It's available on our website, tre.radio. Elizabeth, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.